copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, imagine how the world would be different if liberal theology with its historical critical method would not have arisen. All ancient Western churches, which were existing at the time when it occurred around 1800, were affected to the core. They were changed to the core in the course of the decades of the first decades of the 19th century or later. At any rate, nowadays, all the old churches that existed during the Reformation, perhaps, but especially during that time around 1800, they were all changed to the core. Now, that is a big change. That is an enormous change. They all gave up traditional doctrine quite substantially, and imagine that that even had effects on history. Had the German church not developed the way it did, the German Christians would have been much stronger. Now, what else could have changed? Well, we know the catastrophes of the 20th century. The claim is not obviously, I can't predict what would have happened, but of course Christians were very weak in Germany at the time when that occurred, when the Nazis came and the other catastrophes that there were. They were not equipped well, they were confused, and the development of the German state churches were an enormous factor in that confusion, and from there it spread out to the other parts of the world, perhaps not to all parts, but probably to your country too. That is an enormous event and an enormous development of ideas. We need to look at what happened there. We need to know it even today, because even today the very same ideas are at work. And I want to explain my account of that, and I want to encourage you to watch out for these ideas and to understand what's going on and to be smarter than some other people were with respect to it. The historical critical method is often presented, or it was presented to me when I studied Protestant theology at Munich, it was presented as just the method of taking historical facts into account. So apparently other theologians were so naive that they didn't do historical research, that they didn't investigate what the situation was in the churches to whom Paul wrote these letters. That's the usual story. It was historical research, the historical critical method, which started to take history seriously. Now, that's not at all true. The historical critical method is not that, because, of course, Christians had always done that. That's most obvious. The core is something else. And to go right to it, I quote Ernst Troeltsch, a German theologian, now 1889, so we are about 100 years later than Schleiermacher, around 1800 it got started, I would say, but he made a very influential and specific and precise statement of the method which is at the core of liberal theology. And he writes, no change can occur, he writes and says that is a principle of theology. No change can occur at one point without changes occurring before and after at other points, so that all events stand in a continuous correlative interconnection and must necessarily constitute a single flow in which each and all hang together, and every event stands in relation to others. Now, that's a slightly complicated way of putting that everything that occurs, occurs as a result of causal processes. Everything that occurs, occurs as a result of causal processes, and other authors would add, as described by the laws of nature. That's what philosophers call determinism. Every event is predetermined by preceding events. And in Rudolf Bultmann, who is very famous for these kinds of statements about miracles, we find it in a slightly different form. He writes, the idea of a miracle as a divine intervention has become impossible for us today because we understand all that happens in nature as law-governed. So laws of nature are meant. Thus we understand a miracle as a violation of the law-governed connection between all that happens in nature, and this idea we cannot entertain anymore today. Not because such an event would contradict all experience, but because for us the idea of nature includes being governed by laws, not because we observe this, but because we presuppose this, and we could not avoid this presupposition even if we wanted to. There are other famous statements on Bultmann on miracles where he says we cannot believe in miracles today, where of course the thinking reader will think, how do you mean we cannot? I mean, there are many people who do, and even people who are well-informed and rational, or academics or scientists. How do you mean we cannot? Now, there is more to the cannot, namely, it's a Kantian cannot. It refers to Kantian philosophy, where Immanuel Kant has a whole scheme of epistemology and metaphysics where human beings have certain rules of thought which predetermine how he has to think. They are the presuppositions for thinking and for speaking. So we are wired in certain ways, and many things that usually people think are in the world, Kant says are in the head. So causation, for example, Kant says that's not that one event causes the other one out there. No, that's you have to think that way. You are ordering things in the world like that. And I just explained that when Bultmann says that, he means that Kant has shown that we have to think that way. Bultmann says we are wired so that we have to assume that every event is predetermined by other events. And he refers with this to Kant's principle of causality. Here it is. Every event is determined by a cause according to constant laws. He says that is an a priori law, and that means for Kant it's wired in our brain. We have to think that way. We cannot think otherwise. So that, I think, is the main root how this idea got into Protestant theology, because Kant was very influential on theologians, or those theologians who followed Kant were promoted by the government in Berlin. So I think that's one of the main roots how Kant was so influential, that through his principle of causation, Germans in particular, in the 19th century, German academics, believed that determinism is what has to be true. There is just no doubt it's a principle of rationality and of science. To give you a quotation from a non-German philosopher who took this up in the 60s, Langdon Gilke in the US, he says, contemporary theology does not expect, nor does it speak of, wondrous divine events on the surface of natural and historical life. The causal nexus in space and time, which the Enlightenment science and philosophy introduced into the Western mind, is also assumed by modern theologians and scholars, since they participate in the modern world of science, both intellectually and existentially. They can scarcely do anything else. So there you have the term causal nexus. This is again what Troeltsch was describing in this slightly longer passage. Everything is connected, and so if there is one change, it's got to be due to a certain change before, and it's linked to certain changes afterwards, and all that is law governed. So causal nexus is here the name, and here we see the Enlightenment, the connection with the idea of the Enlightenment, and we find that very much in 19th century German theologians, and even in theologians today. They say, since the Enlightenment, we think that way, or we know that, and that's where we are. So, and they would also say things like, we cannot think otherwise, or they will say that Enlightenment has taught these things. That's a kind of I don't like the term narrative, but you know what I mean. Now let's go into the historical background of this doctrine, and we find determinism in a very clear form in Thomas Hobbes, I think, for the first time, 1655, in his Elements of Philosophy. And he is reasoning just philosophically, not looking at events, not looking at science, but just thinking, well, if an event occurs, then its cause must have been complete, otherwise it wouldn't have occurred. Now, if the cause was complete, then the effect could not but occur. So it necessitated its cause, its effect, didn't it? And the result of this reasoning is the following: whatsoever effects are hereafter to be produced, that means whatever happens, shall have a necessary cause, so that all the effects that have been or shall be produced have their necessity in things antecedent. That means they are determined. That's what philosophers mean today by determinism. Every event, everything that occurs at a certain place, at a certain time, is predetermined by preceding events. And that's described by laws of nature. Hobbes didn't add that, but that's what the other authors then assume. And that's what Kant here adds in his principle, according to constant laws. The laws are constant and they govern every event. We could form a slightly more general concept than determinism. If you, through knowledge of quantum theory, gave up the idea that every event is necessitated by preceding events, there is still the idea, and therefore conclude that they're also probabilistic processes. If you take that on board, then what remains of determinism is that every event is the result of a process, be it deterministic or probabilistic. That's why I use the term mechanicism. But for simplicity's sake, I will just continue with the term determinism. And just as an aside here, that the Enlightenment, that's a complicated story, what the Enlightenment is, and I actually think it doesn't exist in the way it's usually conceived. But the authors that are usually called Enlightenment authors, they all subscribe to determinism. So one can give the account that was an essential doctrine for being called an Enlightenment author. And that refers, for example, to Leibniz and to Christian von Wolff and to Kant. That is to say, there were opponents of Leibniz and Kant, other philosophers, who rejected that principle and who were Christians, by the way. Leibniz and Wolff, of course, also were Christians, perhaps of a slightly, not entirely orthodox or slightly critical of some aspect, but they endorsed this determinism, which their opponents, for example, the Christian August Crusius, who was a pietist Christian, rejected. What are the consequences of determinism? Well, the consequence is, first of all, that there are no miracles, because a miracle would exactly be an event that is partly brought about directly by God, and that occurs instead of an event to which physical processes would have led. That is, if, let's assume, God were to move a stone, for example, the stone from Jesus' grave, let's assume God did it directly, not through the angel, then had God done nothing with it, what would have happened? It would have stayed there. But he moved it. So something occurred which nature would not have brought about. So there was a causal process in an abstract sense towards the stone just staying where it is, and God moved it differently. That's the idea here. Nature was going one way, and God brought about something in that situation and stopped that process in that way. So that's excluded through determinism, because such an event, which is the miracle, is not the result of preceding processes, but of God's decision, God's action. And that's true for miracles. Now, by a miracle, we usually mean a divine intervention which means something to a certain person, with which God does something to a certain person or communicates something to a person. There are other divine interventions. For example, during creation, God intervenes to create a certain kind or to input certain information or however you describe that. So there can be divine interventions for creation, and it follows also from determinism that there were no divine interventions during creation. In fact, the question of Hobbes derived from determinism, first of all, that there is no free will, not free will of the kind that people have believed in it before. And in fact, I would be asking whether there can be living creatures. It depends on how you understand living creatures, how you understand life. Certainly, there would not be free agents, and I would even question whether there would be agents at all. I mean, something that just occurs in a causal process, like the rolling of a billiard ball, I see reason for denying that that's an action at all. An action is something that the agent determines for reasons or out of an inclination. It's not a causal process like a clockwork or like the moving of the planets. That's just as an indication what else might follow from determinism if you take it further. And So the main conclusion that Hobbes drew was that there is no human free will. That means there is not even limited human free will. Theologians sometimes are not clear about that. I think nobody affirms that human beings have unlimited free will. That's a position that's not plausible. But limited free will is what Christians usually believed in. And Hobbes denies that, and it follows from his determinism. Now, if there is no human free will, according to what most Christians used to think, rightly, if there is no human free will, then the whole story of Christianity about sin doesn't seem to be really so plausible, because there doesn't seem to be sin in a very deep sense if there is no free will. What would temptation be if there is no free will? What would be the point of that feeling of temptation if all that's going on really is just a process that's predetermined anyway? So, and furthermore, there would be, what would be the point of the Great Commission to call people to convert if it was predetermined anyway what happened, who went where, and who accepted the gospel? That doesn't seem to be the story of the New Testament. The story of the New Testament seems to be there is something up to human beings, and it can go one way or the other way. People can accept the gospel or they can reject it. God pushes them or draws them more or less, but often they have a choice to go one way or the other way. And, of course, if there is no free will, then it seems as though the evil is really pointless. There can be no point to it. If God arranged everything that way, what would be the point of evil? That's just to indicate what Christians usually believed, I think rightly, and why determinism was such a complete attack on Christianity, because it removes free will and it removes miracle, and there is basically nothing left of Christianity if you take that away. You can't modify Christianity so that it just fits that picture a little bit. What, of course, the liberal theologians did, I won't go into the details of liberal theology, that's another matter. What they did is they said we have to now reinvent Christianity in order to make it fit determinism. So we have to get rid of all miracles and interpret these sentences differently. We have to use the old sentences, because otherwise we lose our jobs and the people will recognize that we are not Christians anymore, and they will realize that that's not the Christian church anymore. But the point and the really extraordinary feature of liberal theology is that decision of Schleiermacher to continue to use the old phrases and to fill it with new content. That was really an enormous idea, and it's actually extraordinary that he thought that should work, that he gets away with it. And it's extraordinary that he did get away with it. And if we can still see it in the pews, at least in Germany, that there are these ministers who were trained to use the old sentences but not believe a thing what they usually meant. And most people in the pews don't realize. They don't realize minister he repeats the old sentences about the resurrection of Jesus, and then in the sermon he talks about hope, and there is always hope, and there is always something that can go better, and it's always worth going on. And they think, oh, that was a good sermon. I mean, there was the reference to the resurrection of Jesus, and there was hope. That must be a good sermon. What they don't realize is that the minister spoke about this hope because he thought the resurrection didn't occur, and all there is to it was a metaphorical meaning, or we can draw that lesson from it, that it's worth trying something new. I mean, it's worth carrying on. Where the Christian way to preach would be to refer to the historical event, the historical resurrection, and take that as a reason for everything else that happens in a Christian life or a Christian heart. So we rejoice because God has won a victory over death. And we spread the gospel because we believe that Jesus really is the Messiah. And we know that because Jesus rose him from the dead. So for the normal Christian, all this the link of reasons is there, and the liberal theology takes it all away. But that's about all I want to say about how liberal theology then proceeds. I just want to discuss about this presupposition determinism. Just to mention one possibility that could be considered to be an alternative or a way out that came through quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics introduced the idea of probabilistic processes, that processes are not deterministic, so that it's fixed what will happen, but there is a certain room. There are forks in future possibilities. It can go one way or the other way, and there are certain probabilities attached to the various ways how future could develop. That was, for many at the time, when quantum mechanics arose, that was already too much. They said God doesn't throw dice. That's because in the 19th century, determinism was among intellectuals in Germany such a fixed idea. They took it to be a principle of rationality. That's why quantum mechanics was such a shock. If you look at quantum mechanics, okay, it has surprising things, but then it's looking at a very small level, so it shouldn't be that surprising. But for 19th century Germans, it was a huge shock because they were taught and believed it to be a principle of rationality, and taught by the greatest German philosopher that ever existed, that everything is fixed by future events. So there you go. And then probabilistic processes came into being. Now, let me just address the possible view that with probabilistic processes, actually, it can be true that every event is the result of a causal process, and there still are miracles, or free will for that matter. The trouble with that is that it's still causal processes that are going on, even if they are probabilistic. And if an action is the result of a probabilistic process, that doesn't increase free will in the sense of that we mean when we say the action was free. It makes it just a matter of accident which action occurs, but it actually would diminish responsibility. So that's not kind. Although we rightly say if a person is free, he could have done differently, and although in one sense the sentence "he could have done differently" is true if the action is a result of a causal process, but that's not really what we were looking for. It's not the sense of "he could have done differently" that we are looking for. It's just a sense of arbitrariness. So it doesn't really work to rescue free will by reference to probabilistic processes. And with divine interventions, it's similar because now if God intervenes in a probabilistic process, it's still an intervention, even though it was a probabilistic process. But it's still an intervention. And if he doesn't intervene, it's improbable that the miracle will come about. And even if he does intervene, he would change the relative frequencies which the probabilistic laws describe. So the idea that somehow we could reconcile mechanicism with miracles through probabilistic processes, I think, does not work, and we could continue that in the discussion. Now let me go to my objection against determinism. My objection against the view that that's obvious or a result of science or a principle of rationality. Let's look at a law of nature, as we all know it from high school physics, and let's see whether the laws of nature really confirm what these liberal theologians assume. Let's look at whether the laws of nature really say that there is that causal nexus which Langdon Gilkey referred to, or what Troeltsch referred to, and what Bultmann referred to. Because it was commonly thought that way, that the laws of nature fix these regularities. They fix what follows what. and we had it in Kant's principle of causality. It's all described by the laws of nature. These people thought it's the laws of nature which describe how this deterministic network is developing, and which describe if there is an event of one type, what will follow, and what will follow in all occasions. That's why miracles are not possible. Would not be possible if this deterministic view would be true, and this view of laws, because when a miracle occurs, God brings about something in a situation which on another occasion, where God does not intervene, is followed by something else. So if there is a miracle in one situation and a similar situation except without the divine intervention at another occasion, so in one case the stone is just sitting there and in the other case God moves the stone, then you have the situation where one type of event, X, in one case is followed by the stone just sitting there and in another case the stone moving. So let's look at the laws, whether they really were as these determinists thought, and what does the law of gravitation, which we have here, say? Well, I mean, there is an F, which refers to force, and there is G, which refers to a constant, and there is M1 and M2, that refers to the masses of two bodies, and there is D, which is the distance between the two bodies. So what the law says is that in a situation where there are two bodies, one here and one here, at a certain distance, and one has a certain mass and the other has a certain other mass, the bodies, well, what does it say? Does it say they move in a certain way? No, it doesn't say that. It says there is a force at the bodies of a certain kind, of a certain strength, in the direction towards the other body. That's what the law says. So the law just says that in situation of certain kinds, there are forces of certain kinds. Now, what does that mean for miracles? Consider the stone. What's happening if God moves the stone? Well, he moves the stone. What about the forces? Now, the forces is what's proclaimed by the law. The claim of the law is that there is that force when there are two bodies. And what happens to the forces when God moves the stone? Well, nothing happens to the forces. Presumably, the forces are still there. God just moves the stone. Because forces can be counteracted. Forces can be counteracted by other forces, that is, by other physical things, or by a cat, or by a human being, or by God. Forces can be counteracted. That's just because the nature of causal processes is that way. And we can see that here in the law of nature. The law of nature is not that whenever there are two bodies, they accelerate towards each other. That's the picture that Troeltsch and Bultmann seem to have. They seem to think the laws say whatever happens in what kind of situation. So that would mean for the law of gravity that the law says whenever there are two bodies, they accelerate in a certain way. No, they don't. Because sometimes the one body is glued to something, or there is an electromagnetic force on it, or there is another planet working on it, or for that matter, a ghost or God is acting on it. Anything could act on it. But the point is, there is nothing about the thing and about the causal process and about the force which rules out that something else is acting on it. And there is nothing about the force which forces that acceleration to take place, which would take place if nothing else was acting on the thing. So in a miracle, no forces are presumably abolished. Perhaps there are, I mean, it's a matter of debate whether that could happen, but we can well imagine that in miracles, no forces are abolished. And that means the laws of nature are left entirely intact. The laws don't say what happens. The law just says what happens in a certain situation if nothing else is acting on the thing in question. And that means that the famous phrase that miracles are violations of the laws of nature is not right. That's wrong. And the phrase was introduced by Voltaire and by David Hume. They both called miracles violations of the laws of nature and used that to rule out all miracles. They said, we have so much evidence for the laws, and therefore no evidence of a miracle could override that. Let me illustrate the point in a different way and illustrate the point why determinism is wrong in a different way. Here, that's a ball here. And look at this. That's a causal process. That's a ball rolling. The rolling ball, the rolling of the ball is a causal process. That is, it involves things, bodies, and there is something going on through time, and it has a certain predictability. It follows laws of nature indeed, so that we could predict what happens if nothing else is acting on the thing. Now, on the Hobbesian view of matter and of the laws of nature and of the universe, something would not be possible. What is possible? What can happen with the rolling ball is that I stop it. Now, so I can stop the ball. Now, my opponent might say, yes, yes, okay, but that's naive, really, because, of course, your body is a physical thing, too, and you have your brain, so that you have to take all that into account. That's also a physical system. Well, okay, let's take more into account. Let's include more in the process, not just the ball and the table. Include whatever you want. Include my body, my brain, and whatever you want, what there is, whatever things you want to include. The point is that whatever you include, the same is true of that big thing, including me, the ball, my brain, and the table. Of that is the same thing true, what's true about the ball, namely that whatever process it's involved in, it can be stopped by something else. So even if you include me in the process, which involves also the ball, that whole thing can be stopped. And that just illustrates the point that causal processes can be stopped. Causal processes can be stopped by some other thing which is not involved in the causal process. And for whatever there exists, whatever material things there are, there can be other things. I mean, if that ball exists, that has no implication on whether there is a certain other ball. That's left open. And you can include as much as you wish. There still could be other things. And these other things could stop the ball, could stop the process, and this big process. And that just illustrates the simple point that causal processes can be stopped. And if causal processes can be stopped, determinism is not true, because determinism is the view that if an event occurred and was caused, nothing could have prevented it once the cause was in place. And the truth is, and the relatively obvious truth is, yes, something could have stopped it. If A caused B, philosophers talk that way, if A caused B and A did occur, then something could have prevented B still at that point, because A was before that, or even at the point, something could just stop it, like my hand stops the ball. So that's the nature of the processes in our universe. They go in one direction, and they might not even be probabilistic. There might be no probabilistic processes for that matter here. We don't need probabilistic processes for miracles and free will to be possible. It's enough that causal processes can be stopped. And that's obviously true. We know it from our everyday experience, and it's confirmed by a closer investigation of the laws of nature, which have that kind of form. And you can make it more complicated. You can investigate various laws of nature or other formulations of the law of gravity. It's always going to be the same. The laws of nature are not affected by miracles, and they have no implication on miracles, and they have no implication on free will, because causal processes can be stopped, and they can be stopped by other processes, by human agents, animals, by God. It's just a question whether these things exist. Now, of course, the atheist who says there is no God and therefore there are no miracles, that's all right. That's a reasonable argument. If he has arguments against the existence of God, that's something one can discuss, and that's worth discussing. But the point of this kind of reasoning from Hobbes and in liberal theology is that we can know that there are no miracles without ever having investigated whether there is a God, and without ever having looked at the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus or other miracles. This liberal theology chose an entirely anti-empirical approach, an entirely a priori approach to something which should be investigated with our eyes and with empirical investigation. So that's my reply to determinism. And I emphasize that there really is nothing to this determinist principle that liberal theology uses. And we do need to distinguish between arguments that can be refuted or to which there are good objections and arguments which are really no good at all. And this one, the one that liberal theology presupposes, is really one that's no good at all. It's just confusing people. It's important to see that. We shouldn't overuse that argument. We shouldn't say all the time when we disagree that argument is no good at all, or say there is but there is a difference also between arguments from atheists, arguments which are worthwhile discussing, and arguments which really hold no water at all. And in addition, we could look at more authors, but you could see that already from the quotes from these liberal theologians. They put no effort into it at all to argue for it. I mean, they put it forward in the most dogmatic way, saying you cannot believe that anymore, and it's a principle of science, and it's a priori, we cannot think otherwise, and they give no argument at all. I mean, you even find theologians sometimes saying, since Kant we know, or since the Enlightenment we know. That's that kind of reasoning which is really an anti-rational reasoning. Now, talking about reason and rational, and liberal theology was called rational, and rationalism was the mindset that led to it. Now, that is quite a misuse of the word, because is that reason? Is that really reason that's governing liberal theology? Is that reason which governs the idea that we know just from the armchair that there cannot be divine interventions? Well, I think with the arguments I've given, it's seen quite obviously there is no reason at work at all here, and it's just being dogmatic. You can call it foolish or clever, but it's certainly not reason. So it is a fatal mistake to say that liberal theology used reason, or that it emphasized reason too much, or that somehow it put reason at a too high place. That's not the problem of liberal theology. That's a mistake, I'm afraid, that sometimes Christians make. German Christians who were critical of liberal theology also did that sometimes, and they said that's there. You see where reason is taking you. If you lose all your faith, and it's all that. If you put reason too absolute, then you start to deny all miracles and so on. That's a fatal misunderstanding. That's not reason. Reason leads you to see that this argument is rubbish. And it's important to have that attitude. And sometimes the New Testament also uses this term foolishness and so on. It's important to see that. Because reason, I mean, we don't want to deny reason. Nobody should, and Christians don't, because reason is sort of semantically immune against being something bad. It's like truth. You want to have it if you are rational. So, now there is that word reason in the New Testament, and I think it just confirms my point, but it's sometimes used to confirm this other, more anti-intellectual attitude. There is in 1 Corinthians, in the first chapter, this long passage about the wisdom of the world and how the gospel relates to it and the cross. And there is that one passage, "Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of the world?" Well, and sometimes that's taken by Christians to mean, well, you see, reason really leads you in the wrong direction. You just have to follow the Bible. That's a misunderstanding. And we see exactly confirmed what Paul is writing here. This wisdom of the world, that's exactly what liberal theology is. Because they were the ones who claimed to be the embodiment of reason. They claimed they are the rational ones. They really claimed that everybody who disagrees with them has no reason at all. And they still do that in Germany to theology students today. It happened to me, at least, when I was a theology student. The New Testament professor said from his pulpit, well, if somebody of you here really were to believe these childish things and wanted to continue with his children's faith, he would really not be in the right place in a study of theology that is wissenschaftlich, that's scientific. That's the kind of pressure that's put on people. Wow. And and it's associated with reason and with rationality and with the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment just is that kind of project or rhetorics which says, well, now we are bringing reason. So that's the story behind it, just to indicate Enlightenment. That's a story that reason was brought into the darkness of Christianity, and determinism is a crucial element of this kind of rhetoric. That is, they call determinism reason. They baptize that. That is the rational view they stipulate, and anybody who agrees with that is enlightened, and any who isn't is superstitious and is not reasonable. So that's the kind of, that would be another talk to talk about the Enlightenment, what was going on there. But just let us understand here, wisdom of the world, that means that people say they are following reason, and in fact they overly emphasize reason. I mean, it's normal and not bad for everybody to think that his own view is the rational one and the opponent's view is not the rational one. That's all right to a certain degree, and we do that too. There is nothing wrong with that, because you believe you're right and you believe to have reasons. That's good. But if one goes around all the time and saying, well, I have reason. My view is the reasonable one because I follow the reasonable principles, and the others really don't have reasons. If that's overemphasized, as it is in Enlightenment rhetorics, then that's at least a reason for being skeptical. And I take Paul here in Corinthians to make that point. Well, watch out if not always those who claim to be rational or wise, not always those who are considered to be rational or wise, they're not always on the right track. They may well be on the wrong track, and they may well very often be those who reject the gospel and who say then that it's not rational. That's, I think, the right approach, and there is a connection then to rationality and liberal theology, but it's that one and not the one that liberal theology followed reason too much. So I think Romans 1 also confirms that or speaks into the same situation. In verse 22, Paul says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. That's something I think that we could well apply here. Practical advice to finish. Now, it depends, of course, whether you are exposed to liberal theology. If you were to study theology, that might be stronger. It depends on your country. Not everywhere that is very strong. But, and of course, there are other kinds of liberal theology now. But still, this was an enormously strong line of thinking. And all these claims which you come across if you study theology, even in exegesis about Quellenscheidung, and about saying, well, that verse is clearly later than the other verse. It's it's often based just on that kind of principle, because they presume they know what happened. They presume they know there was no miracle, and then they say, let's think about how did the text then come about. So it's really their defense of their naturalistic position, which they construe, and they present their claim about a certain verse being a later addition. They present that as the claim of historical research, but there is no manuscript at all, and no other reasonable tools of critical textual criticism. It's based on their principle of determinism, which excludes miracles and the supernatural. So here, I'm just saying, when you come across these claims, just check whether it's really not derived from historical research, but from the presupposition of determinism. You can see that, for example, at work in William Lane Craig's debate with Gerhard Ludemann, who's a German New Testament scholar who denied the resurrection. And Bill Craig actually has a hard time arguing with him, because he finds there is actually no real argument. And then he does come to the conclusion, well, but then you just exclude that kind of thing, right? And Ludemann confirms that then. So it really is at work that way. Now, more personally, and for everybody's faith, we know from several passages in the New Testament that if somebody asks God for something, it is a precondition for God's answering that the person believes that God can do that. So this belief that God cannot intervene really is also undermining prayer life, and with that, faith in general. Of course, the contrary is not true, that God always answers our prayers and always makes our beloved person healthy. He doesn't do that all the time, but the other conclusion is not right. We must believe that God is omnipotent and must not be affected by these things. And the being affected happens in small doses. It's not just it's not just being an entire liberal theologian or not, but it starts once you start to think, well, miracles, that really doesn't quite fit with science. I'd rather look for an account. Let's see whether I find a solution without that. There's no justification for this giving in to this little thing. So I'm saying, watch out for what guides you in your investigation and your beliefs, and check them with your reason. I mean, check. Okay, am I thinking I have to explain that miracle because I think the text really looks metaphorical or something, or am I just being influenced by that kind of thinking, and am I being carried away by that? So I encourage you to apply reason here that has an impact on our beliefs, on our theoretical beliefs, as well as on personal faith. If we start to really believe that God is omnipotent, that will undermine our faith. One more instance and example, of course, in concerning creation, this enormous debate that's going on and with which many emotions are connected, there is one thing one can observe sometimes, and that is that sometimes theologians prefer theistic evolution, not because they think the evidence for evolution is so strong, but because they cling to this determinism. So if somebody is a theistic evolutionist because he thinks really divine interventions would be a problem, God would have to somehow set the laws of nature aside, or it's entirely impossible, that would be a very bad reason for accepting theistic evolution. That's just as an example of where it's important to watch out for these kinds of arguments. So, concerning liberal theology, my point was, if you see no reason for the assumption that divine interventions are impossible, do not be impressed by it. And in general, we need to watch out for these inclinations that we are carried away with. They must always check, do I have a reason for this? Does this position have a reason in favor of it? And then only believe a reason that you can really see. Don't believe something because the person is so influential. And that's true for people of all degrees of learning. People, we must also teach the congregations and people in general, believe not something because the person has gray hair or is a professor or has two doctorates. Believe it only if you understand it. If you don't understand it, okay, some people understand fewer arguments, but then just follow your common sense. That's your best guidance. But don't follow an argument just because other people say it's a good argument. Or don't follow an argument or just because the person's a professor or claims to be reason incarnate. So that's an important principle because people are impressed, and we are sometimes impressed. We shouldn't be impressed. We should be impressed only by reasons. So liberal theology is a temptation, and reason can help to resist that temptation.